So is everybody on from your end? Cal, Doug?
I'm here.
Hi, Rivka.
Hi.
Yeah, it was pretty much what we were just talking about. Everything's pretty much settling down.
Is it okay?
Yep.
Jiffy?
Yep.
Great. Okay. Hope everybody is well. Good.
Let me just test the mic here. See that we're on. Yeah, it looks okay from here. And let's go online. And we're going to be picking up from, picking up from 10:10. All right, 10:10 is what we're picking up from. Is the audio okay? You can hear me okay from here? Okay. So we just to recap. Okay, let's see, audio's okay online. To recap, we're talking about a series of verses here that started with beginning of chapter 10. Give me 1 second, I want to have somebody else on a screen not having the sound. So the series of verses was dealing with a conflict that King Solomon was referring to, and that is how, on the one hand, he talks about how wisdom is something which, of course, far surpasses foolishness, and how it's there at the disposal of the person who's wise, and we went into that at length. But the question came up that even though the wisdom is great, and it can actually, we said, it can placate the anger of a ruler, which could be one of the you know, most expressive forms of how wisdom can be effective. Because that's where the most harm could come to a person. And when a person uses wisdom, he can placate the ruler and he can get out of his troubles. Nonetheless, King Solomon said that he saw an evil which looked like it went forth from the, again, mistake from the ruler. Because the evil they saw was that the lowest people were in the highest positions, and the people that were wealthy were in low positions. Servants were riding on horses, and people that were high officers were walking by foot on the ground without any type of a transportation. So he says, you do see that that happens. So he's trying to do is present a conflict, but try to explain what a person should really be subscribed to, what values should a person have. And these values are going to come into question. Okay, futuristic, thanks. I'm glad the audio is working now. And so these questions, these values come into question when there are inconsistencies. And that's the one inconsistency that he cites over here, is the inverse in terms of people in certain statuses. The people that are low are really in high places and vice versa. So that was verses 5 and 6 and 7. Verses, he's showing you that there is an inconsistency, that he's being realistic and presenting what you're going to find in the world. The question is, of course, what's going to be the reaction and how a person will come to any type of resolve and a set of values that they can feel confident in. Because when you have an inconsistency or something is not 100% of the time, so then the concept of being a rule is marginalized. It's mitigated, because a rule is something which is 100%. That's what makes something a rule. Gravity operates on Earth 100% of the time. There's no deviation. Okay, so the question is, how does a person live, you know, what values should a person have in his life? What should be the criteria for what we accept as a value? I mean, certain people, you see clearly that they, and this is the fool, of course, but the people just live with abandon. They don't want to follow rules. They want to have their freedom in life. And they won't, you know, a lot of people looking to get out. I mentioned many times a conversation I had with the person who's a heretic, and they'll use, you know, like a shotgun effect. They'll throw many, many, many questions at you until one of the questions is unanswered. And due to the one unanswered question, they will then abandon or justify their lack of being observant. So again, everything has to be approached reasonably, rationally, and would that be a rational type of approach? And I think we discussed that if a person had two doctors and they had to have a surgery, so of course a person is not going to question his health. You know, he or she will do whatever they can to ensure their health. And if they have to have surgery and there's two doctors that they narrow it down to, one doctor is correct 50% of the time, and 50% of the time he's not. So he's had a 50% success rate in the surgeries and a 50% fatality rate. Another doctor has performed 1,000 surgeries and he was successful every single time except for one. So is it wise to pick the doctor who's half and half, or is it wise to pick the doctor that has a higher rate of success? So of course, the doctor that has the greater rate of success is the one we choose, even though there is that one time that he was not successful. And maybe it wasn't even his fault. But you see, an intelligent person will still, in that scenario, the intelligent person is not going to look at the one case that's in question. And let's make it clear that the question is, it's not any blame of the doctor. Maybe that they just didn't know what happened. Everything was performed, you know, in a perfect manner by the doctor. And it was the wisest, you know, and it would be a wise decision to select that doctor. But that's because a person is objective in that case. When a person is trying to abandon, let's say, Judaism, so they may not be able to answer a lot of things that they, a lot of questions that they'll throw at you, you know. And if there's one question that you can't answer, not that there's not an answer, but let's say you just can't answer it right now, or there isn't something which is 100% satisfactory, that's all that heretic will need in order to abandon it. Even though in the same scenario, that person would not use that. He wouldn't say, well, since the doctor was wrong once out of 1,000 times, I'm not going to use him. So you see, in that very same approach is used in for convenience sake. When a person is just looking for an out from being observant, and I spoke to a person recently who's himself is a different heretic, self-proclaimed. And of course, you're not supposed to engage a Jewish heretic, which this guy was, so I'm not going to be doing that. But until you find that out, you are having a conversation to a certain point. And the conversation went the course where there was a number of, just pot shots he was taking. He's not looking for a way in, he's looking for a way out. So it's important. It's important that a person knows that. And that's what King Solomon's applying over here. That's what he's teaching here, that on the one hand, he's teaching you have wisdom. And we know for sure that that's supreme. And he says clearly in verse 4 that wisdom is something which can resolve some of the greatest problems that you have. If a ruler is angry with you. But then you have a question that comes up. Sometimes you'll find, and you see, we underline this. In the beginning of verse 5, it says, there are times, the Hebrew word is yesh. Yesh means few, minute cases, where you're going to have the inverse. Somebody somehow got to the top, and he really wasn't fit for it. Now that will happen. Now the question is now, so what you see what King Solomon is trying to do is address to the reader, so what should be our approach? What do we select as our choices, our value system? What are the rules that we follow in our lives? We have cases where, you could follow anything you want, but look, the guy who's the fool ends up to be on top. So is it worth it then to even try? Do we take that one case and say that that's a question? Or no? So that's why you keep reading. And that's why he came along. And he said, despite the fact that you have these people that are the fools that are in high places, and you have the servants who are riding on horses, and then the people that have high of really the important status, they end up somehow being even without transportation. They don't have a horse. They're walking by foot on the ground, meaning they're demeaned. Their status is completely reduced. Even though you will find that, King Solomon says, what's the next verse? He says, a person who digs a pit, in it will he fall, and the one who breaks down a fence, he'll be bitten by the snake. The fence was put up to keep out the snakes from his garden, from his lawn, wherever. And the person makes a pit. So now, before the pit is there, you can't fall into it. But now that he created the pit, there's going to be damage. So what he does with this verse is he says, yes, there are cases, like we said, that you'll have a question. But what are the rules that we must follow in terms of practical living and intelligence? Well, you have absolutes. You have one absolute that is in terms of making something which has got a certain depth to it. There is going to be, if you walk into it, you're going to fall and you're going to hurt yourself. And the same thing with breaking down the fence. So you have inanimate and animate dangers. A pit making a big hole in the ground, it's inanimate, and through your interaction there's going to be some danger. A snake is something which is animated. And once you give it an opening, it can hurt you. Now, we asked also last week, why does he have to keep on going to, that was verse 8. Why does he have to go into verse 9 and say that a person who lifts up stones, he'll become pained by it, he'll hurt himself, maybe he'll herniate his back, he'll pull the muscle, it'll fall on his foot. And he says also, a person who splits wood, he'll be hurt by them as well. So Sforno says, he answers our question. Why do you have to give me the second verse? You already told me two dangers. You make a pit, you fall into it. You break open a fence, you can get bitten by a snake. So, all right, I get the message. Why do you have to go on to the thing about stones and wood? So, Sforno explains that here he's talking about things that a person needs. There's a purpose. Making a pit in the ground, there's no real purpose. Just to make a hole in the ground, the truth is you want level ground. That's how you plant. Unless you're making it for a well. But he's not talking about that. He's just making a pit in the ground so you can hurt yourself. Breaking open a fence is ridiculous because a fence is something which you constructed for a purpose. Now you're going to remove the very objective of all that labor to build the fence. But then, so those are foolish things to do. And you see the rule he's laying down, that despite the fact that there are people in high places and there's people in low places. So that's something which is a question. How can that be? You think that, you know, if a person's wise, he'll always be in a high position. If a person's a fool, he'll always be in a low position. But you see that throws a little monkey wrench into the whole situation. But despite that, he comes back and he says there are rules. That's what he's doing now. Just so you see what his approach is. He's telling you that there are rules that you can work with that are steadfast. This is the way the world is designed. You make a pit, you fall into it. It's a dangerous thing. These things are objective 100%. So he's showing you that there are natural laws. Even though you may have a question in certain cases, but do we have laws or not? So you see what he's doing. And then he goes on to say, now that's foolish to just create dangerous scenarios when there's no need. But sometimes you have a need. You have to build a house. You need to move stones. You need to cut wood. You have to warm yourself in the winter. There's no way of avoiding, you know, getting the fuel that you need to cook the food and to warm the house. And here, there's going to be some danger as well. So there are absolutes. So you see what he's doing. Let me just stop here for a second. Everybody see what he's doing. And if you're on screen, you can type on the screen too. Is that clear to everybody? Okay. Okay, so you see now, if you just read these verses, what is he talking about? People on horses, and then a pit, and then a snake by a fence. It sounds like a mumbo jumbo of facts that may be true, but what is the sequence? What is the thought pattern? But now we can see. You see what exactly what King Solomon is doing. He's trying to address the issue of how does a person operate in life? Are there rules? Are there principles that he can follow that are steadfast? And should a person abandon the rules because they have certain minute cases? So he's taking up some very core issues over here. But you see that the lessons that he gives are from natural law. Okay, that's also important to observe, that the lessons that he's giving over here are from how the world operates. You have a pit, you have snakes, lifting heavy objects, breaking wood. I mean, you were talking about big objects. It's a lot of weight you're moving around, so you have to be careful. But there are rules. There are rules how the world works. And nobody would deny these. So although that we'll see people's statuses, and then again, that can be due a lot of, that's actually outside of complete, you know, just the purely natural law. That's involved with people's free choice. That's interaction. That's rulership. And that's what he says. There's an evil I see as if it's like a mistake that went forth from the ruler. So that now you're bringing human error into the scenario. So maybe he's intimating that in these areas, you're going to have injustice because people are not perfect. People make mistakes. But when you talk about digging a pit and snakes and you pick up a stone, it's very heavy. You can drop it. You're cutting wood. You need it, but there's a danger involved. So when you limit yourself purely to natural law, you will see 100% reason. And you'll have something which you can confide in, because this is something which is constant. Natural law is a constant. Okay. But now it goes, so that answers the question we didn't answer from last week. What was the reason for verse 9 about lifting stones and cutting wood? But he already told me the dangers of a pit and breaking a fence. So you see, he's adding something more. Because there, according to Sforno, there you at least you need to do this. There is a purpose in the wood and the stones. But even there, there's going to be, there's certain negatives. Okay. Now he moves on. Interesting verse. Unless there's any questions. Let me stop and see if there's any questions first. Okay. Now he moves on. He says as follows. If the steel is blunt and it was not sharpened, nonetheless, the warriors still become strong, meaning the axe. They're talking about an axe. So if you didn't sharpen the blade and it's blunt, it still strengthens the warriors when they use it. But better preparation or better is wisdom. A better approach is wisdom. Doug, do you have the English there?
Yeah, the one I'm looking at reads, if the iron is blunt and one does not whet the edge, you must apply more strength, but wisdom increases skill.
Wisdom increases skill, okay. So you have it that if the iron is blunt and it was not sharpened, so then you have to apply more strength. The other commentaries had here that it would strengthen the warrior still. Maybe it means that muscular, if you have to use more energy to compensate for the lack of a sharp blade, so then you become stronger, like lifting weights. Okay. But a better skill is wisdom. That's what you have also?
Yes. When it says wisdom increases skill, I said those are similar.
Wisdom increases skill. Okay. There's a number of questions. I mean, what's this verse about? And specifically, what's this? Is there something about an axe and sharpening that he's trying to convey over here? And again, the sequence too, how does this follow through in terms of what is he talking about? I mean, this whole, we understand up to this point very well the series of verses, the context. And now all of a sudden he brings in an example of an axe. Right, so Ibn Ezra says that somebody had a question?
Oh, I was going to say that there's the idea that you can sort of apply a brute force method to something, but if you apply wisdom to it, it's more efficient with less effort. But that doesn't follow nicely from 8 and 9.
It doesn't or it does?
It does not.
Uh-huh. Ibn Ezra says similar to you. He says that the concept that there's a greater skill or a greater benefit with wisdom on any type of pain that you put or stress that you put yourself under. He says better skill is wisdom, and the matter is there is to wisdom something greater on the. The seems to be saying a kol etzav ki tachshir ha'adam, because it's something which prepares a person better. It readies him without any real stress and toil or the waning of his strength. He's giving it practical, meaning if you use intelligence, you can like you're cutting wood, let's say. So if you go against the grain, that would be harder than if you go with the grain. You can split the wood a lot quicker, even with a dull blade. And just as an example. All right, and the Sforno says as follows. He says, if the steel is blunt and he didn't sharpen it, and the warriors become strong, and this happens when a person splits wood with an axe without doing it properly, because if the axe already became dull of the axe head, and then the axe is not really prepared properly, so then the warriors or the strong people will have to be stronger and more steadfast in order to break the wood. So what does he mean? And then he ends off by saying, but better off is a skill, or better preparedness, or better skill is wisdom. Yes, we all have the facts. The question is, what is he doing with this verse?
Rabbi, are we locked into the interpretation that 10 continues from 8 and 9 and doesn't start a separate subject?
No, I'm open to hearing what you have in mind.
Well, in looking at the interpretation that you made of 7, 8, and 9, it seems a little convoluted to try to make 10 fit into that. And I'm just wondering if maybe he's, as he does from time to time, just shifting into a slightly different subject as opposed to continuing the flow.
All right, and what is the subject?
Well, it would seem like he's making a point that wisdom surpasses physical strength in the world.
Right.
May we say not only surpasses, but enhances?
Okay. But to me, this fits in perfect with the series. Because he's, trying to give you rules on how the world operates. And how a person's, practical approach to be and how to answer the questions when you have inconsistencies. So you may have an inconsistency, but you don't throw out the rule. If you can't answer one math problem, you don't say that math is, in all the other cases, it didn't work. It worked in every case, so I have a question right now. Fine, I have a question. So I don't understand why the officers are walking by foot and why the servants are riding on beautiful horses. It's a question. It's a minute case, too. Keep in mind, it's not the rule. That's very important that King Solomon points that out. That word, yesh, there are cases like this. There is an evil that sometimes occurs in the beginning of verse 5. So that's crucial to keep in mind. Because if it was not the minute, and it was the majority of cases, then you'd have to have a different rule. All right? You couldn't say that, wisdom is something which gives you success if in 99 times the person used wisdom and he wasn't successful. So after he gives us the rule that If the ruler becomes, if the king becomes angry with you, don't move from your place, don't budge, use wisdom, and it can placate him, meaning he starts off by telling you about wisdom and how it's a great tool. Then he says, well, there are, and that's an absolute he's telling you. But despite that, you will find certain cases where even the people with the wisdom are not on top, and the fool ends up to be on top. So what do you do with that principle about wisdom? But nonetheless, he says that's a minute number of cases. But he takes you back to the physical world in 8 and 9 and says, you dig a pit, you'll fall in. You break a fence, the snake's going to bite you. You have physical rules. You have laws that are absolute. And even more, even when you don't have to endanger yourself, right, like in 8, but in 9, where you do have to endanger yourself, where you do have to build a home, so you have to move stones and trees. There, you're going to have certain risks too. So he's telling you, you've got, from the physical world, that you have absolute rules. Even though you had a question before about the statuses of people in different positions, he's trying to show you there are absolute rules. Now he goes back in 10, and what does he do? He says, again, there's an absolute rule in the physical. And that is that if the X, and now, but it's a different type of example. What's the difference between the example it gives with X than with the case of the previous cases? Okay. You also have something else, I believe, is that, well, you said that you can expend more effort. I'm not sure. I mean, here it's true. He's saying that that's one view. I think I did see one other one that says that it strengthens. It sounds like there's some benefit. But I think it's smoother to say that, yes, you expend more effort. But you look what he's doing. He's saying now that you're interacting with the world. Before he was telling you that you have a pit. That's the nature of a pit. And it's the nature of a snake, that these things can have damage. And the same thing with very large objects. But it sounds like here he's going more into your interrelationship with it. I mean, how do you, I mean, technology, sharpening something or not sharpening it. So in terms of how you harness the resources of the world, so again, there's going to be rules there that you'll have to use more strength, meaning if you're just dealing with brute force, so that is going to be necessary, but he then wants to show you that don't think that the physical world, because he just talked about the physical and having certain objective properties, because he wants to take you from the question you had about the inconsistency. You saw people that were of different statuses and in inverted roles. It didn't seem just. So he wants to show that maybe the minute times that happens. But let's look at the physical world as the absolute. Okay, so that makes sense. The physical world does have absolute properties. I will fall into a pit and I will get hurt. If I don't fall into a pit, I won't get hurt. But the problem with leaving off about the physical world is now it gives the implication that is the be-all and end-all. And he doesn't want you to have that implication, because there is something which overrides physical law. And I don't mean that it can control physical law, but I mean in terms of man's success. To come out of a scenario successful. So what he does now, I believe the step is that now that he brought a person back and convinced the person through the physical laws about the fence and the pit and stones and wood, that there are physical laws. These are absolutes. So you may have questions in some cases, but you can follow, and you must follow, what you see as being absolute. Nonetheless, he doesn't want you to think that is where you should put all your stock. Because there's one thing which has much more of an effect than the physical. What's that?
Wisdom,
exactly. That's why he says this verse. He wants to show you that although I just gave you examples in order to root you back into the conviction that there are laws, even though there's some exceptions in certain cases, that's no reason to abandon laws, but you can't stop at the physical laws, because even the physical laws, there's something which is more absolute than that. And that's why he says at the end of verse 10 that a better skill is wisdom. Meaning if you just use physical law to achieve certain purposes, you're right, there will be physical laws, and physical law can do certain things. But if your plan is not based on wisdom, so then it'll be, I mean, it's true, a person could walk up a mountain on his hands. But if he uses intelligence, he sees it'd be a lot easier to walk up on his feet. So it's not a falsehood that you can't, you know, that walking up with your hands is impossible, right? It's also not a falsehood that you can chop wood with a blunt axe. You'll have to put a lot more force into it. So the natural laws are there, but when you apply intelligence, your objective is accomplished with greater ease. So therefore, he does not want to leave us just being attached to the physical. That's why I believe he moves on to the end of that verse, and he says, but a greater skill is intelligence. Because that's really what runs the physical, if you understand how things work. If you don't, then you just look at the brute interaction with things without much wisdom. Yeah, you need wood. It's too big to carry a whole tree, so you got to chop it down. Then you got to take those logs and chop them into, you know, smaller quarters. Then how do you go about doing it? So it's true, all those assessments. But when you use intelligence, right, that's why people eventually created buzzsaws. Because they started realizing a quicker and more efficient way, and with less, they could do a lot more, a lot quicker, and without getting tired. So you see, in terms of ingenuity, that's, you know, a basic example that would apply to this case. So he comes full circle. He originally talks about how wisdom can placate the ruler. But then you have certain questions. Well, if you have wisdom and you have, that's something which is can placate the ruler, how is it sometimes people's positions in society is inverted? You're right. It happens sometimes. But let's go back to reality. Don't holes in the ground cause people to fall into it and they get hurt? Aren't there absolute rules? So he makes that step. And then finally, he can't leave you just being attached to the physical and that being the be-all and end-all. So that's why he has to explain that. But keep in mind that all these, you know, there are absolutes in the physical, but your accomplishment, your success, your happiness is going to be achieved far greater when you use intelligence. Now we see what fits in. Okay. Okay, let's take a look at the next verse. So it says, if the snake bites because it wasn't charmed, so of what benefit is it to the charmer? And Doug, maybe you could give me what your version is over there. Okay, so if the serpent, it says if, right? If the serpent bites without being charmed, so then there's no advantage in the charmer. All right. Let's take a moment to think about this. So Sforno takes this on two fronts. And he says that and greater is the elevated status of the preparedness of wisdom, and it's the effects. for example, if it occurs that the snake will bite, if it happens that the snake bites the fools, they break down the fence. And that's really the fence was really something which was supposed to be a guard, that there should not be any need to charm a snake. And what he really says here, he says, this is really words spoken into the ears of those who break down the fence, I mean the fools, to warn them that they shouldn't continue to sin. He's thinking metaphorically. And he says then, once if a person, meaning he says, the person breaks down the fence, it's going to bite him. And the rabbis, I think I said this last week, that they took this to mean that. There's another verse that talked about that earlier. The previous one that we had, a person breaks down the fence, when he breaks down the rabbinic laws, it'll come to hurt him. And then he says at the end of the verse that there's not going to be any benefit to the charmer. And Sforno takes this to mean that this also metaphorically. And he says, because also, if a person of speech, I guess a wise person, speaks into the ears of the fool, it will not help him at all. So he says this verse about a person that if the snake bites without being charmed, the person's not using intelligence, so he ends up being foolish and he keeps on sinning. So then there will not be any benefit to the charmer. The charmer meaning the wise person. Wise person won't be able to help him out if he's a fool. So that's the Sforno. On a straight level, I mean, you could say that now he just finished telling you that wisdom is something which surpasses the physical. But now there's one caveat. If the wisdom is not applied, so then it's no use. Meaning to say that if the snake bites because the person... I mean, if a person ends up getting hurt because he didn't use intelligence in a certain case, meaning he has the skill to charm the snake, or metaphorically, he has the intelligence to avoid mishap, but he doesn't do it, meaning he lets the snake bite, like Sforno is saying, he just lets damaging things happen. He sins, whether it's mundane, whether it's in the realm of the Torah. So if he has intelligence, but he doesn't apply it, so then the intelligence is no use. I mean, he's telling you that applied wisdom is the only benefit. So the person has the ability to charm a snake and he doesn't do it and he gets bitten. So what good is all the skill that he has? So although he told you in the previous verse that it's true there are physical laws and these are absolute, so it shows us how we should live our lives. Nonetheless, wisdom is something which if you have a good plan, you'll be able to harness the physical world in a much more successful manner. But this final idea here is that you have to apply that wisdom. If the wisdom is purely theoretical and it's not being applied, so then that wisdom is really not playing a role. There's no benefit to the person. And Rashi is a very nice Rashi here. Let me read you Rashi. Rashi is on the last verse we just had, which was 10. He says as follows. He says that the high degree of importance, of even more, that wisdom has, more than steel, If a person is a Talmud Chacham, a person becomes a wise individual, and he blackens his face, and he starves, meaning he's involved in wisdom, and blackening his face means that he's not so popular. A blackened face is euphemistic for a person who's not, so well recognized. Okay, and he says also in hunger. That means since he's involved in his wisdom and his studies, so then he doesn't have much food, so he doesn't eat as much as other people, so he's hungry. And then you see him as a poverty-stricken person amongst all the rich people, which of course is going to happen. It'll have to happen. He's putting less time to work, so then he doesn't look as pristine. He's a blackened face. That's what that means. He's not so pristine looking. He's also hungry. He's not like a portly, heavy-set person who's eating all the finest delicacies all the time. He's thin and he's hungry sometimes, and he's poor. But nonetheless, the warriors will become strong through him, he says. Again, because wisdom is going to be something which surpasses all other considerations. I remember the case that we had, that there was a king that laid siege on a city. That's 914. There was a small city, and there are men in it. There are few. And there became a great king and laid a siege on it. And he built great ramparts against it. And there was found in the city a man who was poor, but he was wise. And he saved the entire city with his wisdom. But no man remembered that man, that poor man. And King Solomon said further, and I said that greater is wisdom than power because of this case. And the wisdom of the poor man was despised, and his words weren't listened to. But you see that he saved the whole city. So I believe that he's calling back onto that case here. That's what I believe Rashi is doing here. Even though his face is blackened and he's hungry and he's poor, nonetheless, he's going to be the one that saves. The warriors become strong because of him. He's going to give the right advice. All right, so it comes full circle, like we said before, in terms of giving a person an outlook that is going to be beneficial. And that outlook is going to be where he looks at the world, how does it operate, he's realistic, and he bases his decisions in life on how he sees the world operate, like we quoted Maimonides a number of times, that the person accepts as true that which he sees with his mind, what reason tells him, and what he perceives with his senses, and what he has transmitted to him from the Torah, because he knows by proof that that took place. There was a conversation, an email, had this week with somebody, and he was telling me he was talking to some person, and another person that's trying to wiggle out of his obligations in terms of being an observant Jew. So he says, yeah, the way the story of Sinai could have happened, it started over a couple of people talking, there was a small fire, and over 100 years it became a big fire, and then the few people that were five people, it turned out to be 2.5 million people. And he says, you have this? And he says, I don't think it's so far-fetched that you can have a story changing like this over time. So, and then he wants to say, basically, then, therefore, Sinai didn't really take place. God didn't really reveal himself on the mountain. It was some ventriloquist, and the story got distorted over many years and many people, and so on and so forth. So what would you say would be a good response? I mean, the best approach always is, will you take the information that the person is using as his defense and show him the impossible conclusions based on what he's suggesting? Now, a person who's a heretic, who is foolish, they don't typically, you know, think like a chess player. They don't look a few moves down the line to see what will have to be the results of their theory. Now, this person is saying that over time, all events in history get distorted. He can't say it happens only some of the time, because if he says that, so I'll suggest to him, well, maybe Sinai is one of those exceptions where it didn't get distorted. So he will have to stand by the opinion that it always happens this way. History is always distorted. So if that's the case, would you say that the same type of distortion of that story that happens on the West Coast is going to mirror exactly the distortion that happens on the East Coast? And in the Americas, the people who distort the story there is going to exactly match how they distort that story in Asia? Of course, this person is not going to agree with that. He'll say that, no, since it's being distorted, it's based on subjective criteria. And it'll end up, according to him, that you should have, of every history, not just Sinai, but of every history, you should have numerous distortions, and neither one should match each other. No matter where you are on the globe, you should have many versions of all the histories in the world. Yet, what we find is that for every history in the world, you have a singular story. The characters are the same, the dates are the same, the locations are the same. So the person using his own theory contradicts himself. And so that's the best way to refute. You take the actual theory that they have and you show how it doesn't work out.
I'm sorry, Rabbi, I don't understand. Could you repeat your point about singular history?
Yes, the fact that you don't have two different histories of Rome, for example. Everybody agrees it was Caesar, everybody agrees the location. You don't have two different history books that have two completely different versions of who the emperor was, how many people were. You may have slight variations. Was it in terms of, was it 646 AD or 645? But the fact that you even have such close proximity of the dates shows you that they're all talking about the same thing. But the people aren't different. The names aren't different. So you have a singular history for all nations. We don't say that there was some stories that George Washington wasn't the first president, it was really Lincoln. You don't have such distortions. All right?
Well, we do have numerical distortions.
Yeah, you do have, like I just cited, you have slight changes in dates.
Populations.
Yeah, things that are outside the realm, like, you know, when you talk about, you know, one person can't witness, with exactitude how many numbers of people at a certain event. So there we understand that that's not such a reliable thing. But we know the location. Nobody's in doubt about the Gettysburg Address location, the location of the homes of certain people in Virginia, you know, where they crossed the Delaware, it wasn't the Hudson. So the principle that we have, that Rabbi Chaya explained, when you have masses at an event and the content that they're transmitting is intelligible, so we can rely on it. But sometimes the content is a little bit outside their range. How many people were there? Was it 500 or was it 1,000? All right, there we could understand there's going to be some error. Or the date, was it the latter end of the year, so some people might have thought it was really, you know, the beginning of the next year. But if we're honest and we take a look at history, we see that you don't have any case where this, like this guy was trying to suggest. You'll have slight inaccuracies in the area of things that are outside of the realm of human comprehension. But you never have a mistake of who the person was. You'll never have a story that was not miraculous being made into a miraculous thing witnessed by millions of people. That you won't have. That's too far of a distortion. And if you have, and again, the evidence of distortion you see in the Christian Bible. Because there they have four different gospel accounts. So there you have a case of where you have a rejection of the story primarily because of this very same principle. When the story can't get it right, that's because different people were making up different versions. All right. Okay. So, why did we get onto that? Was that? We got onto that for a reason. All right, so why don't we do we'll wrap it up here. I still want to go further with this verse, but at least, I mean, Doug, tell me now if you see how this is flowing now. We initially were, you're suggesting that maybe 10 was starting a new area, but I think it appears now that verses 10 and 11 are continuing on the theme. And I think it is very, very important, you know, what we've extracted from here, that with the principles that we use in terms of, following, that there are rules, and that although there are minute cases of questions, we don't say that rejects the rule. All right? Any questions or comments before we wrap it up? Interesting, huh? It's interesting how these verses turned out to be some lesson over here, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, I think it's important just to repeat that he didn't want to just leave us with the conviction in the physical world, and that's the absolute, but that's why he went on to tell us that wisdom is something which is a better skill than the sharpening of the axe. I mean, we have to understand that wisdom is something which overrides that. And without a plan, without intelligence, so then we may understand a certain amount of the physical laws and be able to harness them to a certain degree, but the plan and that that comes from study and the Torah that gives it sharpens the mind, and especially the verses like these where we have to think into it and extract and understand where he's coming from. We see how he's moving. He's navigating through the verses and how he wrote them. This actually has an effect of sharpening our own minds. And I'm just wondering if that's something which is he alludes to with the concept of the case that he used, sharpening the axe.
Well, right. I also see a contrast there in 10, in that sort of brute force or physical force, that it can still be effective, but wisdom is not effective unless it's developed as a skill.
You mean if wisdom is not... Well, what do you mean developed as a skill? You mean that it's used regularly?
Wisdom is a skill. It has to be developed. It isn't, in a sense, given. You develop wisdom through experience. Study.
Well, that's a good point. That's a very good point. I mean, it's something which you hone. It's not something which is just adopted or adapted very quickly. It's something which takes time to refine.
Right.
Yes, that's true. That's a good point. It's a good observation. Right. I mean, it's just like sharpening, the sharpening of the steel. Yeah, that's good. All right, so if you want, look over again that next verse by the 11, and you see even looks 12 even continues, it seems to me. But I didn't really go into it deep yet, so we'll look at that for next week. All right? Okay, everybody.
Have a great week.
You too. Have a good week, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. My pleasure. Bye-bye.